So we are now recording the audio as well as the contents of the chat window and the PDF of the deck being presented tonight. We'll all go up on our website later on. I'm now going to do a mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, or you can use the chat window. If you do unmute yourself, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep the background noise to a minimum. So, Alan, take it away with tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. As usual, we have a potpourri of things for your interest and edification. And we're going to start off by throwing it right back to Chris for a share.
Yeah, I happened across this just when I was browsing the membership of our Google groups that we use for distributing messages. And everyone gets subscribed to OPCUG announcements as well as OPCUG newsletter when they join. And I happened to notice that there were some that had their delivery option, or what Google terms the subscription option, set to something other than immediate delivery. So there are meeting reminders that get sent out a couple of days prior to either general meeting or the Q&A night. Alan sends out one about an hour or so before Q&A, and very occasionally there might be other reasons, and those other reasons could be something rather important. If we had a last-minute cancellation or something like that, we're certainly going to send it out through OPCUG announcements to let everybody know. If there's anybody out there that receives their reminders late, usually like the next day, you might want to adjust your subscription option because there's some people that have it set to something other than immediate delivery. Next. So if you go to HTTPS and Google, groups.google.com/g/, and then the name of the group, which in this case is OPCUG hyphen announcements, and then make sure that you are logged in using the email address where you receive your postings. So you should see it in the top right-hand corner. And then if you click on My Membership Settings and Subscription and see what that's set to. If it's set to each email, then messages will get sent to you as they're posted. So you should receive it within minutes of it having been posted. However, if you have it set to Digest, what Google Groups does is it bundles up 25 messages before sending them out, and then it'll combine those into a single email, and it'll be sent at least daily. If it's more than 25, you'll get when 25 hits, and then it'll start bundling again, and it'll go out in bundles like that. If you have abridged, what you'll do is you'll get a summary of up to 150 messages combined into single emails and sent daily. So both those options can cause delay for sure. So next. And so if we look at three Google groups that you can belong to, the first being OPCUG announcements, it's very seldom that there'll be more than one posting a day. So there's no real benefit to having either of those two options. It's just going to delay it. But it's not that you're going to avoid a flood of messages or anything like that. So the recommendation is to set that to each email rather than Digest or the other one. OPCUG hyphen newsletter, it's very seldom that there's more than one posting a month. So, again, the recommendation is to avoid delay. You may as well get it immediately as soon as it's sent rather than waiting a day later to get it. So set that to each email. The last one is the OPCG hyphen member hyphen forum. And that one can be quite active. Sometimes there's many, many postings a day. And so you may not want to be bothered by having postings in your face all the time. I find that it's pretty rare that anything gets posted there is time sensitive. So you may want to have it bundled up and sent to you in bundles of 25 or 125 and delayed up to a day, yeah, may not be really an issue. So recommendation on that is really whatever works best for you, either getting them singly as they're posted or bundled up and sent within 24 hours. There are some cases where you may have problems adjusting this. If you got subscribed to it without actually creating a what's known as a Google account, which looks like an email address, but it is possible to subscribe to a group just with the email address that is not a Google account. And so in that case, you might have a problem trying to do that adjustment. If you do want to go in, check them or adjust them, and you're having a problem, just email me and let me know how you would like each of the groups that you subscribe to set, and I can do the change for you if you need it. So.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Next up, we have a follow-up from last week. If I can get the slide to change. And you may recall Natalie was asking about wireless or wired mics for video photography using as a smartphone and a gimbal unit. Stuart provided some information from a user in Los Angeles who basically reviews mobile equipment and has a, in particular, has a, an audio kit playlist. This is a YouTube channel, and he has multiple reviews of microphones. So maybe that would be a good source to look for information. An interesting one, which I haven't thought about, from Bill Van Dyke, he thought a wired microphone might not be a good idea, because the wire, of course, might well interfere with the gimbal action on the device that you're trying to keep the smartphone stable. So that's certainly something to think about. Okay, moving along, we have a share from Linda, and this is a watch out type story, I think.
Okay, thanks, Alan. It'll be a quick share. OnStar has an app that starts your car, unlocks your doors, checks your tire pressure, all that kind of stuff, as well as a GPS locator. And the one for the Cadillac is called My Cadillac. And Gilles Veilleux of Quebec City sold his Cadillac to a dealership, and he didn't uninstall the phone app that he used with this My Cadillac phone app. And the new client that bought the car obviously didn't know that this app even existed. So next slide, please. So Gilles was able to track his car to St. Louis, Missouri, and the reporter of this article that I was reading, it was actually in my French class, and the reporter went down to try and find the new owner, and he found the car with the GPS. He found the car parked outside of a 70-unit apartment building, so he thought, oh, you know, what are the chances I'm going to run into this family? But sure enough, they came out to all go out to the restaurant for breakfast. And so he approached them and explained, and he says, I have this guy, Gilles, back in Quebec City, and he's going to start your car and flash your lights. And sure enough, he did on cue. And so these poor new car owners were just, you know, flabbergasted that this could happen. So the reporter called GM and the dealership, and both denied any requests to be interviewed. So the warning is beware the fine print on any OnStar products, because apparently when you click on that agree thing, you agree to notify GM if you ever sell you have to uninstall, or they help you uninstall, and they have to set up a new account for the new person, etc. So it's kind of on you, but it's kind of scary because most people aren't going to read that fine print, but now you know.
And I think it's not a magic car, it probably drives away by itself.
Yeah. I think it goes beyond just OnStar as well. I think any smart devices that you dispose of that you sell or transfer over to ownership to somebody else, if it has an account associated with that, probably best to disable that. And if you buy a smart device, make darn sure that you're disabling the other person's continued access to that device.
Yeah, I'm picturing somebody buying my refrigerator, and they keep telling them, go buy meat, and they're vegetarians or something. You ran out of bacon again.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. A few years ago, we bought a used Ford Escape with a Navi system, and it not only had the previous owners, all their destinations and everything, because the phone links in with it, it had all their phone contact information.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, basically anything that was on their smartphone was on the Navi system.
Yeah. So even if you're selling back to a dealership, like I thought, well, maybe the guy made a private sale, but he sold back to a dealership. You think the dealership would have given them a heads up, but.
Yeah, they should clean up things like that for sure. Yeah. But I guess you have to take ownership of that and assume that, you know, nobody else is going to take care of it for you necessarily.
That's right.
And Tom's just posted a link where you can reset your OnStar module.
Excellent. Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Thanks very much, Linda.
Yeah.
And moving on, we have a question came in about, basically saying that in the good old days of DOS, there was a limit of 512 files that you could have in any given folder. But now in Windows 10, this person has directories containing more than 3,000 files. So the questions were, in Windows 10, are there limits? What's the limits for the size of a file, the number of files in a folder, the number of subfolders that can be in a folder, and the size of any given drive partition? And I actually put this question on the members only forum, and Bill Van Dyke again gave some information. And basically, if you're running NTFS, which I think probably most people are on the Windows, and you're allowed to have 4 trillion files in a single folder. And as long as you don't have more than 4 gigabytes for any given file, and the disk space taken can't be more than 2 terabytes. It turns out, I actually looked at some of this stuff, the 2 terabytes is actually a limitation if you're using 32-bit addressing and a master boot record type partitioning scheme. Modern systems will use 64 bits. They use GPT partitions and UEFI firmware interface. And if you have those conditions set, then you have a theoretical limit of drive space of 9 zettabytes, which are billion terabytes. That's more than on any of my flash drives, I think. But there are some specific limitations. Basically, everything depends on the operating system and the file system. So if you're running Windows and you're running NTFS and you have a GPT drive, then you can have 128 partitions, which is a lot more partitions than I have on any of my GPT drives. And each partition can be up to 18 exabytes of disk storage. And there's no limit to the number of folders that you can have on any given disk volume, but there's that limit of 4 trillion files. But now, because you're using 64-bit addressing, the maximum file size goes up to 256 terabytes.
So, correction, Alan. That's only 4 billion, not trillion files. You can only have 4 billion files.
Oh, heck.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, it's a billion, yes. 1,000 million, yes. Anyway, the bottom line is, I don't think I have 4 billion files even on any of my disks. So as far as I'm concerned, and the source I used to get this, he said basically, practically there are no limits. You're going to run out of disk space before you hit the file and folder limits here. And I think that's probably true. I don't think there are any disks right now which will hit those kind of numbers. Anyway, there you go. Interesting information. And one of these days, it'll be like Bill Gates, you know, nobody's ever going to need more than 3 megabytes or whatever he said, you know, and now we have gigabytes of disk space. Well, eventually we're going to have exabytes and petabytes and zettabytes, I should think.
Kilobytes.
Kilobyte, did he say?
Yeah, 640.
Okay. You never need more than that, right? Okay, we had another question came in, basically whether the webcam was working. And this member had been on Zoom calls, including our Q&A session, I think, and had no personal image on his webcam. And basically he was looking at a kind of a blank screen. But everybody else was as per normal. So basically, he was looking at the integrated webcam in his computer and looked at Device Manager, and Device Manager said everything was working fine. But clearly it wasn't working, so he was concerned that maybe device manager wasn't aware that the camera was actually malfunctioning. So the question was, did he need to buy an add-on webcam instead of the integrated one, or were there other suggestions? Well, one of the things you can do, of course, is to test the camera. And if you look at this link on Screen Rant, it basically tells you to go to the start icon on Windows, select camera from the list of apps that comes up in the start menu. And when you load the camera, then it will display the normal picture. Or at least, if it displays a normal picture, then your camera is working. And the article also talks about previewing the image in Skype. But because we're using Zoom, everybody probably knows that you can check out the video settings in Zoom, well, the Zoom client anyway, which is what I use. If you go to settings and video, it will actually show you the picture that your webcam is seeing. So that will tell you whether the camera is working or not. Anyway, then what happened was our member goes off to visit his son in Nova Scotia, and his son's pretty tech savvy, so he starts to look at things, and he thinks the camera really isn't working, and then he finds a function key on the keyboard, which was turned off. And this was probably done accidentally. The member says he doesn't use the touch bar because the symbols are so small he can't make them out, I guess. That would be my problem. But basically, by turning this switch on, then he finds that the webcam is now working again. So this is probably good advice if you have any device which isn't working or doesn't seem to be working, because we probably all know about hardware switches for things like the wireless card and Wi-Fi, and the one that controls the speakers. If you want to mute the speakers, there's usually a switch, a function key to do that. But clearly, on some machines, you have a hardware switch that will enable and disable the camera. So anytime something doesn't work, maybe you should have a little look around the machine and see what kind of switches are available to you. Okay, another question that came in was the TPM. We know that Windows 11 is going to require certain CPUs, but it also requires that the computer has a trusted platform module, which is a security module. The question is, that's for Windows 11, but the question is there any advantage in having a TPM in a Windows 10 computer where you don't actually, it's not required, but is there any advantage to having it? And then the second part of the question was, is Microsoft looking at requiring something other than a TPM chip for future versions of Windows 11? So if you look on the web, there's all kinds of chat about this. And basically, Windows has a built-in system called Cryptographic API Next Generation. And this is essentially a common API is application programming interface. So this is a common interface for apps that use cryptography. And I guess it makes it easier for programmers to use the TPM and make secure systems in all kinds of different ways. Windows also has a platform crypto provider, and that is basically used to access the properties of the TPM. So this can be used for things like security keys and certificates, a secure boot process. We're all familiar with BitLocker as a full disk encryption type system, and that uses the TPM. And also Windows Hello. Windows Hello and Windows Hello for Business both use the TPM as part of their security system. And there's also something called Credential Guard, which I guess is something to do with logging on to things. And then the bottom line is there any importance for TPM for consumers? Well, this article from Microsoft, the documentation page, basically says, TPM is behind the scenes. It's running in the background, essentially, but it is still relevant. And it, again, it talks about Windows Hello and that kind of stuff. And it says, in the future, it will be a component of many other key security features in Windows. Now, the date there is 12/03 of 2021. That's last year. And since this is probably an American website, that probably means it's March rather than December. But it's relatively current, and that's the most up-to-date information I could find. So I suspect that for certain applications, even in Windows 10, TPM is actually being used, although it's not necessary as it is for Windows 11. Okay, anything in the chat, Chris?
Some other sites you can go to get information about whether your system has a TPM. Does Intel PTT BIOS software serve the same function as hardware TPM?
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be similar. I don't know if it's the same.
Yeah.
Okay, good enough.
I think that's it.
All right, so moving along, we go to Android and a special feature from Stuart, who's just about to unmute his microphone and talk to us about TV Bro.
Maybe. Yo. Well, as the slide says, I read about this app a little while ago and just got around to playing with it last week. I have a Chromecast with Google TV plugged into my television. And Google TV and Android TV, it's Android, but it's a slightly locked down version of Android. Kind of like Chromebooks used to be sort of like Chrome, but not quite. You can run almost everything. Anyway, one of the things that they don't do particularly well is have web browsers or web browser apps good for them. And the ones that do work are very, really basic. Anywho, this one said that it worked really well with a minimal footprint and utilized the remote control very well. And I'd like to report that it does. The interface is a little weird for my tiny little male brain to understand, but I mean, I'm getting the hang of it, and it's essentially a basic web browser, so you can go look at websites that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do with a Google TV or Android TV, unless it was something specifically designed by the manufacturer, because there are many varieties of television apps that have different browsers that sort of work. But this one does work, and I like to use the media player Kodi. And as an Android app, TV Bro actually pops up as an Android app within Kodi. So this gives the media player a web browser interface that it otherwise wouldn't have. And it's got an ad blocker built in. And it works. And if it's of relevance to anybody, it's sourced out of the Ukraine. Kind of a useful little tool for your Chromecast or Android television box or whatever it is. Not a straight up Android. There's all kinds of web browsers that will work just fine with that. But these Google or Android TV devices can be kind of funky. That's all.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. And I noticed Allison had just put something in the chat, a different way of finding out that your webcam isn't working. Basically, some of these cameras have a sliding cover, kind of a privacy type issue. Or I've heard of people actually putting a piece of sticky tape over the camera so that bad guys can't turn the camera on and see what you're doing. But clearly, if the slider is covering the lens of the camera, you ain't going to get a picture. So, good point, Alison. Thank you very much. Something else to look for. Okay, now I think we're going to some antivirus type stuff. And the question was, basically, do I need an antivirus app for my smartphone? Now this member has been receiving some strange email messages, and some of them look very much like scam type email. But she's basically been ignoring them and running Windows Defender, which always comes up clear, no malware on the system. However, she's wondering if she has been scammed, and so she's not very happy about opening these emails, which are somewhat dubious. However, she thought that Windows Defender would protect the email if it was on either the computer or the phone. And she also thought they shouldn't have more than one virus scan running at the same time. So I guess she's thinking that she shouldn't have virus running on the computer and on the phone. Well, I don't think so. Defender basically monitors files that are being opened or being saved on the computer. And it's running full-time on access scanning. So as soon as you try and open a file, Windows Defender will check it out and make sure it's okay. Files on the phone are basically completely independent of files on the computer. And even if you have the two systems linked for some time to transfer files, let's say, Windows Defender can still only see the files that end up on its hard drive. So if you're concerned about security on your phone, then you really should have an antivirus app on the phone in order to provide security for your Android device. And both Chris and I, Chris actually suggested this, I think, Chris and I both use the Sophos, and the current version is called Intercept X, Intercept 10, I guess, Intercept X for mobile. You can install that basically from the Play Store. So basically, if you call up the Play Store on your phone and type in Sophos, then you will get a list of all kinds of things. And the thing to look for here is Sophos Intercept X. And then when you do that, it will bring up the app. You can go to install. And now it will start asking you a bunch of questions. It basically, in order to be able to scan the files on the phone, it has to have access to those files. So you have to give it permission to do various things. So basically read what it's asking for and decide, yes, this is okay. And down here, allow the app to do these various things. And basically, if you don't allow it to do it, I don't think it works. So I think you'll find you have to allow it to do what it wants to do. But it is a security system, so you probably should let it work the way it wants to. And then once you've done that, then it will actually do a scan of your system, and here's my system once it's been installed. And it's basically found a couple of problems, one in device security and one in app security. And if I click on the device security here, it pulls up this screen. And see, I've got green, 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 and then red. And the problem is I don't have a screen lock configured on my phone. So you have to decide whether that's a concern for you and maybe you enable a screen lock. Or if you're not concerned, I'm not concerned about having a screen lock on my system, then you can actually disable this test next time around. So once you've gone through all the systems that it's found and figured out what's best for you, then you should end up with this thing where you have all green lights on all the things which are important, like device security and Wi-Fi, network security, and app security. I don't have corporate management managing my device, so that one is basically not applicable. Okay, so that's it for my suggestion for a security app for Android smartphones. I'm sure there are lots of others out there which you could use, and maybe some are not much better than others, I don't know. I've always found SOFOS to work in the background, and it basically doesn't bug me every 2 minutes that something's wrong, and it doesn't have to update itself every 5 seconds either. So it just seems to, it just works. It just works in the background and seems to do the job. It will give me a notification every now and then that it scanned something and everything's clean, which is kind of reassuring. So I'm pretty happy with SOFOS Intercept X.
I've been quite happy with it as well.
Okay, I don't see anything else in the chat, I don't think.
Nope.
So another thing that Chris recommends in his, if you look at his security, computer security presentations in the past, he often will tell you, you know, to keep your virus scanner updated, which is really good advice. And it probably doesn't matter which antivirus scanner you use because they all work pretty well. However, if you are concerned that maybe your particular virus scanner isn't doing the job, you can actually double check it by running a one-time scan. And so even if you, like I use Windows Defender, again, it's built into Windows. It updates with Windows every time Microsoft thinks it needs to. It runs in the background and nothing bad ever happens as far as I know. But, okay, as it says here, an occasional check with respect to viruses can't hurt. And Chris suggests a free online scanner as a one-off check. And I stole this slide or some of these items from his presentation. And there's a bunch of different one-time online scanners that you can try and use. And just for the hell of it, I chose ESET, the first one here, and decided to see what happens if I run this as a one-time scan on my system. So if you go to the website, you get the ESET's free online scanner, which is, I like free, that's good. It's a one-time scan to check for malware. So basically click on the one-time scan, and it will pop up this window, and now you can download the the installation program. So we save that, and then basically run the program. So get started, off we go. And of course, you have to read the what's it called, the end user license agreement, the EULA, and carefully check all of those things, and before you press accept. Yeah, sure. But now you do have some things to think about. It wants to know whether you want to send data back to ESET and whether you want to enable feedback. So you have to decide whether yes or no you want to do either of those things. And once you've made your selection, then you can continue. And now you have to choose a scan type. Well, clearly, it's a one-time scan, so I'm just going to run a full scan and let it run as long as it needs to. But before I can get the scan running, it now wants to know about POTS. Or actually, it calls them potentially unwanted applications. I've heard these called potentially unwanted programs, POTS, which are much easier to say. So these are adware, spyware type things that are not necessarily malware per se. They're not necessarily going to do bad things to your system, but maybe they're reporting back to home base in terms of where you're browsing and that kind of thing. And maybe you would like to have a bit more privacy on that. So you can enable looking for POTS or disable it as you wish. And now finally you can say, start the scan. So here we go. Oh, well, no, we're not quite ready because now what we have to do is download the current set of virus signatures. And that seems to be pretty comprehensive. It actually takes a little while to download all these signatures before the system actually gets going. But basically, we're not in any hurry. We just let it run until it's finished. And now we're running, and it's actually doing the scan. It's giving us a progress report here, how many files it's done, how many things it's detected, and there's a kind of a progress bar running over here. And I forget how long it took on my system. I basically just let it run overnight, I think. And I don't remember whether I could tell how long it took or not, but I suspect it probably took a couple of hours to chunter through all the files. And basically, when it finished, it said that it actually did detect something. It detected one threat, right? No threats found. So it didn't find any malware, but it did find one potentially unwanted application. So it says it's cleaned all the detections, so it's done the job for me. But if I want, I can check the results that it found to see what it actually found. So if I click on that, then it tells me that it found this program. It's actually a link library, dynamic link library file over here. And it's a variant of this thing, and it cleaned it by deleting it, which is fine by me. I'm sure I didn't need that thing, and if it's a pup, then good riddance to it as far as I'm concerned. So now the next thing, we go to the next screen, and now I'm surprised to find that although this was a free one-time scan, ESET is now offering me to scan my computer once a month with a periodic scan activation. And even different than that, or worse than that, there doesn't seem to be a way to stop it doing that. You notice that I have the option to continue, and I don't think I have any options to turn it off, which is kind of interesting. So there we go. Thank you very much. You can send feedback if you want. I didn't send them any feedback. And you can do a short survey if you want, and now you can close it. So now my question is, well, how do I get rid of it? I would like to kind of uninstall it. It doesn't show up in the control panel uninstall the programs thingamajig. So I looked on the web, and I found this web page here. Actually, it's a support page from ESET themselves. How do I get rid of it? And it basically says, after every scan, you have the option to delete. Well, actually, I didn't, if you remember. So I didn't get a checkbox letting me delete the application. However, it says, if any files were quarantined, the scanner directory won't be removed. So it did detect something. It didn't say it quarantined it. It said it deleted it. But maybe that prevented the thing from popping up the message to delete it. However, it tells me if I want to manually uninstall, then what I need to do is get rid of this folder, this directory, from the user's subdirectory on the C drive. And you can see basically what it's done. Rather than installing it in program files or something like that with all kinds of registry entries, it's actually installed an executable in this folder, in my user's folder on the C drive. So if I just get rid of that folder, that gets rid of the one-time scan. So if you don't want it to do periodic scanning, you can actually remove it. Okay.
Alan, I got a couple of things. Go back seven slides.
Back seven slides. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah. Now, this is something that I'm really not all that happy about with ESET. There's one class of potentially unwanted applications that are almost always flagged by antivirus products, and that's remote control programs. Now, if you installed a remote control program, it's probably something you actually want. If you didn't install it, then it's probably something that is really unwanted. Somebody attacking your machine or something installed it, and you would want to get rid of it. Notice that there is no option to detect, but just ask you what to do about it, right? So you can either detect it and it'll get rid of the program automatically, which I wouldn't want in the case of a remote control program that I installed on my computer. Or the other option is you don't even detect it. So that to me is not a great choice that you have to make there. So I would typically do it where, yes, I do want to detect and quarantine those programs, but then I'm going to have to fix something after the fact if they remove something that I decide I really do want that program, even though they think it's potentially unwanted. So that's one issue that I thought. Go forward, I think.
Just before we move on, though, you notice that it also says that I enabled it to detect and quarantine, but it didn't do that. It found one, it detected it, but it deleted it.
Yeah, and Tom mentioned that too. Quarantining is better than deleting. So, he said is a reputable brand for AV products, but I don't like the way they set this up. Now, if you go forward about four slides, maybe five slides,
The good news also is, though, Chris, I actually have TeamViewer installed on this computer, which is a remote control software, and it didn't detect it.
So maybe they are only going for things that they really think that nobody would want on the system. That could be that they're being very, very safe on it. So if you move forward to where it asked you if you wanted to do a monthly scan. It's farther on.
This one.
Okay, there. I think that green box there with the check mark, that's a slider. So if you turn that off, then I suspect that you will get a checkbox then that says, do you want to delete the application on closing? If you leave that checked, it doesn't make sense to ask you if you want to delete the application because then it wouldn't obviously be able to do the periodic scanning. So I suspect that option to delete the application on closing will only appear if you turn that off.
Yeah, that's probably true. It's just it's not really obvious that that's a slide.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And I didn't see anything else in the chat about online scanners.
I guess the good news is that even though it detected that pop on my system and deleted it, at least it did tell me what it was. So
yeah,
it had been something that I really wanted. I guess I'd know to reinstall it. But I agree, that's not a good scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, if they quarantined and gave you the ability to recover it from quarantine, that's the ideal. Just say, no, I really want it. Put it back where you took it from. Yeah. Undo the damage you did. But I do highly recommend that people do periodic on-demand scans like this. They're free. And even if you think your antivirus is wonderful, no antivirus program will detect absolutely everything. Especially brand new malware, it might be a day or two a week before your antivirus vendor discovers that particular new variant of some piece of malware and gets protection out to you. So it's not a bad idea to periodically do a check with another product, and rotating amongst different products is not a bad idea either. Yeah, so 1 month to ESET, 1 month. I've done with a couple of the ones that are out there, and I've been pretty happy with them. Trend House Call is another one that seems to run really well, and I've had no issues with it. So,
okay, good. Thanks everyone for the input. Okay, a question that came in: full disk encryption. How do you turn on full disk encryption in BIOS safely? And this is a good question. I mean, I don't know. I looked in my BIOS on my laptop, and there are no options whatsoever to turn on full disk encryption. So I suspect if you can, it must be manufacturer specific. Anybody have any experience with full disk encryption and in particular using the BIOS? If you do, put something in the chat or we'll come back to this question later on. In the meantime, the second question, why do my desktop icons get disarranged every month or so? And here's a desktop where I would say that my desktop icons are pretty well rearranged. They're not, certainly not in the order I normally have them in. The question is, how does it happen every month or so? I don't know. I've seen this a couple of times. When I was giving presentations at the libraries and using an LCD projector, it had a different resolution, a lower resolution than my laptop. So when you change the screen resolution, it would change the location of the various desktop icons. And the other way that you can get icons to change is by using the context-sensitive menu in Windows. If you right-click on the desktop and choose View, a couple of options. One is to auto-arrange the icons, and that basically says, okay, Mr. Windows, you put the icons for all my applications anywhere that you wish. Or alternatively, you can align the icons to an invisible grid and basically give them some kind of structure, but you still have the ability, I think, to place them where you want within limits. However, if your icons do get rearranged, especially if they get as badly rearranged as I just showed you, what I do is I use an application, a little utility program called, the one I use these days is called Desktop Restore. And it basically gives me the ability to save my current desktop layout. And then if things go south, I can call up the menu and restore the layout to the layout that was saved. So the way I would do that is, again, right click on the desktop anywhere. And now I go down to the embedded program here. Desktop Restore has embedded itself into the context menu. And here's where I can save the desktop. But here's where I can restore the desktop that I've already stored away somewhere. And when I click on Restore the Desktop, bingo, all my icons jump back into the usual and loved arrangement that I normally have. So I don't know why desktop icons get rearranged by themselves, but this is certainly a good fix if it happens frequently and you have a very favored set of icon locations that you want to maintain. Save that layout and then restore it if it gets messed up.
There's a question from Natalie. Is there a similar program or app for Android phones? I sometimes have icons go missing.
A good question. I don't know.
Yeah, I can certainly echo that. I was doing some cleanup on my phone, getting rid of some apps and finding that some had huge amounts of data storage, and I was doing a cleanup on those. And then all of a sudden I noticed that all of the extra icons that I had moved from the app menus to the so-called desktop menus, they had all disappeared, and I had to remember, oh, what did I put on there? Where did I have it? So that, you know, and I was several days of things not being in my familiar order. So I'd be interested in that as well if anybody knows of it.
Yeah, Natalie says I do the same thing. I take screenshots to remember where things were.
Yeah, I suppose that's one way. Yeah.
And I've done the same thing with Windows. I take a picture of the installed programs or something like that. Stuart says his version of Android allows him to lock the home screen layout.
Hmm.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
Natalie says it's a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
And Tom says, for what it's worth, you can put icons in folders. You can have multiple icons in one icon. I hate that personally, but you can certainly do it.
Just thinking, too, if you wanted to drive somebody nuts, what you can do is take a screenshot of their desktop, then hide all the icons and put their wallpaper to what you took a screenshot of, and then watch them try to launch their applications by double-clicking on their wallpaper. But don't tell them I told you to do that.
April Fools.
Okay, so now we're at that time where we've run out of prepared slides. We have about 10 minutes left. So there's lots of time for questions or things that people would like to share. So I don't know if we've had anything in the chat from stuff we had before.
Nothing I've seen so far.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
So I have an old version of Corel PaintShop Pro, and I tried to install it on a different computer. And I keep getting a message. I have the license. I have everything. It's a CD. And I keep getting a message saying that I need an internet connection. So I thought maybe my firewall, I don't know, turned it off. Nothing was working. I'm just wondering, could it be that it's just an old version and it's not being supported to be installed now? Like, I don't know what's going on.
Lots of apps require internet access to kind of validate your code and so on, and they do this to make sure that you're validated. This is the case for when you install Windows too. You need to validate through the internet. So that's probably what's happening. Now, are you connected to the internet?
Yeah. Like there's no issue. It's just it seems to be blocked, or Corel's not accepting it, or I'm not sure what's going on. I mean, I installed it on my old computer long ago, and it's fine. I just don't know what the problem is. It keeps giving me an error message saying I need to be connected, and I am.
Well, the most probable reason is that because it's an old program, it's using an old URL, an old link that they no longer support. But fortunately for you, Corel is located here in Ottawa. You can give them a phone call and say, help.
Yeah, their help is usually pretty good. But I think that is what is happening. It's a license manager that is reaching home to see if your license is still valid and that it hasn't been the same license key used on a dozen computers or something like that. But, if you call Corel's help, they should be able to help you sort it out for sure.
Thanks.
We have Serge Eric says to sort icons the way he wants, he uses Startup Fences 4, which is a $13 Canadian program. It allows you to set up, I looked very briefly at it, Serge, you may be able to describe it better, but it allows you to set up these groups of icons on your desktop and organize them much better than just the standard Windows desktop for sure. We had a question from B. If you have Bitdefender, can you use Windows Defender to do a one-time scan? By default, I believe it will automatically do, I think it's a weekly scan of your computer. Certainly, if it's not on by default, it can be enabled. And I seem to recall at one point getting a prompt saying, do you want this to happen or not? But it's a good idea. Because, again, it'll just do an on-demand scan periodically. So it's good double-check on whatever your active antivirus is. Okay, and Tom, I don't see anybody having chimed in on BIOS encryption other than there was a question back, I guess. I've lost it now. If I can find it.
There's one here from
Timothy. Tim. Yeah, saying, wouldn't you need a password for the BIOS as well when using the drive encryption? That would sort of be my guess as well, that because it's not part of the operating system or being loaded on top of the operating system, if the BIOS is doing the encryption, then you would need some boot up password, I would guess, and then it would unlock the encryption and then allow the operating system to load. But yeah, I've never seen it in any of the BIOSes that I have on my computers either, so I'm really not sure about it.
Old disk encryption seems like a sledgehammer to solve a nut problem to me.
I disagree. It's actually a very simple thing, because what this means is that there's a key inside the BIOS in some secret location, maybe in that TPM, that then needs to be entered at some point, and then you have complete access to the computer. Otherwise, the whole disk is obscure to anybody. Even if they take it out, they can't access it. So it's a lot safer than, for example, having a Windows password or when you can boot to Linux and then access the file system.
Well, I use a program just to create a container and put all my encrypted files. I put all my sensitive files in this one container, which is encrypted. And that's the only thing I really worry about. Okay, a couple of minutes to go. So while everybody's thinking of more questions, let's go back to screen sharing. If I can find my screen share, which I think is right here.
Yep.
Okay, talk about upcoming things. We had our first tech talk on Monday. It was very successful. We had a whole pile of people there and went through all kinds of cleanup type processes. But the next tech talk is on a completely different subject. It's on photo editing. Our very own photo guru, Linda, is going to be talking about basic photo editing, including software for Windows and Mac. So Stuart's going to be able to use his iPad to do his photo editing, maybe. So again, if you're interested, you have to register. Even if you're a member, members are free registration, but you have to register because we send out the Zoom link, which is different from our normal meeting link, only to those people who are registered.
So not to disappoint Stuart, but it won't work with an iPad, but it has to be a Mac OS system.
It shows you how much I know about Apple computers. Anyway, basic photo editing, May the 2nd. So you've got a whole month to think about it. But if you want to attend that session, then you have to register. So the link is right there. Next week is our regular April meeting. We have a couple of really dubious characters, speakers.
Well, one, anyways.
Yeah, one anyway. That's true. Yes, I agree with that.
I won't say which.
And it's going to be an Office Smackdown. So we're going to be basically looking at Microsoft Office and LibreOffice as two Office suites and the good, the bad, and the ugly about all of the above. So that might be kind of interesting. Anyway, that's next week on April the 13th. And because of the regular meeting, there won't be a Q&A next week. So the next Q&A will be in 2 weeks on April the 20th. And right now, I think the cupboard is absolutely bare. So if you have any questions or you have items that you'd like to share, send them along to suggestion box. All contributions gratefully accepted.
Question.
And that puts us right on the nose, I think, of 8:30. Oh no, Tom's waving his hand. So
yes, why is Linda's seminar still called Spring Cleanup? I thought that was the last one. The link.
It isn't called Spring Cleanup.
Yes, it's at the bottom.
All right. Don't go to that address. Go to opc.ca, and you'll find the correct URL to get to Linda's session. Yeah. Sorry, Linda. Thanks, Tom.
I think at the time that you were putting this together, it wasn't yet posted. And so I think it is now available, and I will post in to the chat.
You're absolutely correct. That's
correct
why
link.
It's in red. It's in red to remind me to change it before tonight.
And it is now in the chat window, so you can either just go to our homepage, scroll down to the bottom, or pick up the link that I just posted into the chat.
Okay. So we now are at 8:30. So thanks everyone for attending. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you next week at the meeting, SmackDown, or
thanks,
in
folks.
2 weeks at the next Q&A.
Well, I hope everybody will be there next week. It should be a fun time.